Good evening, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Cubberly Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. It is my pleasure to introduce Roxana Saberi, journalist and author of Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran. Roxana attended Concordia College in Minnesota. She earned a master's degree in broadcast journalism from Northwestern University and a second master's in international relations from Cambridge University. Born in the U.S., she moved to Iran in 2003 to work for Feature Story News, where her reports were broadcast internationally. Later, she freelanced for the BBC. After Iranian authorities revoked her press accreditation in 2006, Roxana continued to file stories for news outlets like NPR and ABC Radio. In January 2009, Roxana was arrested by the Iranian authorities and charged with espionage. She was sentenced to 8 years in Iran's notorious Evin prison. Her arrest and imprisonment prompted international attention, and with broad-based diplomatic pressure, the charges against Roxana were finally reduced. She was released on May 11th after spending 100 days in custody. Since her release, Roxana has been speaking out for Iran's prisoners of conscience, as well as for Iranians detained in the aftermath of the disputed 2009 presidential election. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Roxana Saberi.
Time used to be so precious for me, but in solitary confinement in prison last year, every minute felt like an hour, every hour felt like a day, and every day felt like an eternity. I wasn't given any books, except for the Quran, which was in a Farsi language so poetic I couldn't easily understand it. No pen and no paper. So I had to try to pass my time in other ways. I exercised a little bit. I did push-ups, sit-ups, some jumping jacks, although I had to be careful not to hit my hands on the wall because the cell was kind of small. I played some piano by tapping my fingers on the wall. And I sang to myself any songs that I could remember. Christmas carols, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, although I couldn't remember all the reindeer's names. And We Will Rock You by Queen, although I had to sing very quietly so that the guards wouldn't overhear me. I had to keep sane because I was cut off from the world. No one knew where I was. I was afraid, and I was alone in Evin prison. I was alone with my thoughts, and I had time to think a lot. One of the things I thought about was freedom. Freedoms that I used to have, that I used to take for granted, but now that I had been deprived of them, I valued more than ever. The freedom to make a phone call freely. The freedom to tell my family where I was. The right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. The right to remain silent. The right to have a lawyer. I want to tell you how I ended up in prison, but first, how I ended up in Iran. My father met my mother in Japan in the early 1970s. And then they got married in Iran a little while later, and a bit after this picture was taken, they moved to the United States, where my brother and I were born. Piano played a big role in our lives growing up. Here I have a very bad haircut, and I think I gave this one to myself. As a child, I went to Japan a few times, but I never went to Iran. And in college, Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, I played soccer and I majored in mass communications and French. I wanted to be a foreign news correspondent, but at the time I was thinking of going to a country where I would use my French speaking skills. Before I could get started on my news career, I took a little detour. The director for the Miss Fargo pageant said she had only 3 competitors and she needed at least 4 to hold the pageant. I couldn't walk in high heels. I was afraid of wearing a swimsuit on a stage. But my mother heard there was a talent competition and I had just quit piano lessons. And she thought, well, if she joins this pageant, maybe she'll practice. So she encouraged me to join, and also I heard that there were many scholarship opportunities. So somehow, after I joined, I became Miss Fargo, and then Miss North Dakota, and then I went to Miss America. And I got enough scholarship monies so that I could go to do my master's degree the next year at the Medill School of Journalism in Illinois. And they send their students to Washington, D.C. to report for a quarter every year. After this, I got a Rotary scholarship to go to Cambridge in England, where I studied international relations. And after that, I went back to Fargo, North Dakota, my hometown, to report. And then I went to Houston. And during this time, I was increasingly interested in my father's native country of Iran. I wanted to learn the language. I wanted to understand the Iranian culture and society better. And I wanted to report from Iran because I knew the country would be full of stories for years to come. So while I was reporting in Houston, I got an offer to go to Iran in 2003. One of the first stories I covered was the anniversary of the death of the founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini. Every year on the anniversary of his death, thousands of Iranians descend upon his shrine just outside of Tehran to commemorate his death. I'm standing up there on the right, and there's another journalist there to my left. And we are wearing this all-enveloping black chador. It's a kind of hijab, which is the Islamic covering that women have to wear in public in Iran. All the men were on one side, all the women were on the other. This is a member of the Basij militia, the Islamic militant vigilante group in Iran. I came toward the end of President Khatami's second term in office. This is a press conference that I attended. During his time in office, his 2 terms in office, there was a relative opening of the media. More and more reformist publications got permission to print. More foreign journalists were allowed into Iran, and so were more dual national journalists like me. But the conservatives had fought back. And the conservative judiciary had jailed many journalists, shut down some publications, and sometimes vigilantes would raid the offices of newspapers. When President Khatami was leaving office in 2005, he held a dinner for journalists. It was a goodbye dinner. Many journalists liked him. They liked reporting on him, and they liked his personality. He was very friendly. And we all jostled to get turns to take pictures standing next to him, and this was my turn. That evening, I saw a few women journalists crying, and I said, "Why are you crying?" And they said, "We're just not sure what's going to happen to our field of journalism under the next president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad." This is the day that President Khatami, who is sitting on the left, handed over the presidency to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who's on the right, and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is in the middle. The previous supreme leader, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, is staring down from the picture up there. Under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's presidency, there were increasing restrictions on journalists, on both domestic journalists and foreign journalists. Several foreign journalists had their visas revoked or not renewed. A few dual nationals like me had to give up their credentials. In 2006, my press pass was revoked. But I believed outsiders had a greater need than ever for independent news from Iran, and I felt a responsibility to help provide it. So I continued to report, but in a limited way that was allowed by law. I also started to work on a book about Iran. I thought, well, I have a lot more time on my hands, and I'm not ready to leave the country yet, so this is actually perhaps an opportunity for me to write a book about Iran. I wanted to go beyond the headlines, beyond what I could say in a short news report, to talk about different sectors of Iranian society. Fast forward to 2009. My book was almost done, and I was getting ready to leave the country to move on to the next chapter of my life. Then at 9 o'clock in the morning on January 31st, my doorbell rang. I was asleep in my pajamas. I got up, and I saw that the monitor in my living room had lit up, and I saw the black and white image of a man standing there, and he said, "Khanam Saberi," it means Miss Saberi. I said, "Yes." He said, "You have a letter." It must have been the mailman, I thought. I buzzed open the door. He came up. I opened the door of my apartment a crack. And when he arrived, he handed me a slip of paper. I thought, this is very strange. It's just one slip of paper. It wasn't an envelope. And he just stood there, waiting. So I started reading it, and it was all written in the Farsi language. I was feeling very uneasy, but the two words that stood out to me were Evin prison, the most notorious prison in Iran. I became very afraid, and I said, sorry, my Farsi reading skills aren't very good. Could I just have a moment to read this? And I tried to shut the door on his now smiling face, but he wouldn't let me. His foot was propping the door open. He forced his way in, and behind him came three other plainclothes men. They were intelligence agents. They started rummaging through my belongings, confiscating what they liked. Some books, some notebooks, family photos, my passports. I was in Iran on my Iranian passport. They also took my American passport. My laptop. They told me, "Stand in one place so we can see you." I couldn't call for help. If I screamed, maybe nobody would help me. And these men could be armed. They said, "Cooperate and you'll be fine. We're going to take you elsewhere to ask you some questions, and if you cooperate, we'll bring you back home tonight. If not, we'll take you to Evin prison." They took me to a building with no sign on it, somewhere else in Tehran. And they started to question me for several hours. Some of their questions were very bizarre. But the focus of their questions were about the book that I was writing about Iran. They said, "Why did you interview so many people?" I said, "I needed a good cross-section of Iranian society, and I can't interview just five people and say they represent the whole country." "Why did you interview reformists?" they asked. "Some of them can be critical of the government," they said. I said, "Well, I also interviewed conservatives," and they basically said, "That wasn't good either." "Who paid you to write your book?" they asked. I said, "Nobody. I don't even have a publisher yet. I'm paying for it out of my own pocket." "Does anyone have a copy?" "Yes," I said. "I used to email chapters to my mom in America." They didn't seem to like that at all. They knew I was going to leave Iran soon, and they knew I wanted to publish the book overseas. In Iran, if you want to work on a book, research for a book, and actually write the book, you don't need government permission, but if you want to publish the book in Iran, you do. So they seemed annoyed that the government would not be able to censor what I was going to write if I published it overseas. I realized through these several hours of questioning that they had that day that what they wanted me to say was that my book was a cover for espionage for the United States. I said, "It's not a cover for anything, it's just a book." They kept pressing, and I kept denying it, and they said that evening, "We're so sorry, we didn't want to have to do this to you, but you haven't been cooperating, we'll have to take you to Evin prison." They started driving up north, back toward my apartment. I thought wishfully, maybe they just wanted to scare me into not writing the book. I'd heard they had sometimes questioned other journalists, foreigners, researchers, and so on for a few hours to warn them about their work or to get information from them about their work, and then they let them go on their way. Maybe they wanted to do the same thing with me. But they kept driving past the turnoff from my apartment and straight to Evin prison. As I said, it is the most notorious prison in Iran. Many political prisoners are held there. Student activists, women's rights campaigners, web bloggers, journalists, members of NGOs, even physicians. I knew that there were reports of torture there. And I knew about the story of Zahra Kazemi. She was an Iranian-Canadian journalist who was detained there in 2003. A few days later, she died mysteriously, and no one was ever held accountable for her death. I was taken to this gate. It says Bazdashgahe Evin, Evin Detention Center. And then I was taken to a building inside this gate, blindfolded. And taken to a corridor that looked like this. I found this picture and the next couple of pictures on the internet. They're from a group called Human Rights Activists in Iran. I later learned that this section I was brought to was called Section 209, where political prisoners are held, and it's controlled by the intelligence ministry. That night, when I was taken there, the intelligence agent who had brought me there rang a buzzer, and then I felt a cold hand reaching out to grab my wrist, and then I was pulled into this corridor, and a woman's voice whispered, "You can remove your blindfold now." I removed it, and I saw a woman guard. She took me down a hallway that looked like this, except all the doors were closed. I later learned that these were other cells for political prisoners. At the end of the hallway, I was taken into a cell that looked like this. It was a solitary confinement cell meant for one person. It was pretty small. By holding out my arms, I could almost touch both walls. I thought maybe it's 7 by 9 feet. The toilet there in the corner didn't work, the guard told me. If I wanted to use the bathroom, I should press a button on the wall that was near the door. A light would go on outside the cell. She would open up the door and let me out to use the bathroom down the hallway. There's a sink there, but she said, don't drink the water from it. The floor was cement, and there was a ratty brown carpet lying on top of it. There were a few blankets on the floor. I was supposed to sleep on the blankets. No pillow and no bed, of course. There's a window up there out of reach. Mine was welded shut, and there was metal mesh on top of the window, so there was very little sunlight coming in during the days, but there was a light bulb on 24 hours. There's also a little window in the door, but mine was latched shut. And there was a sign next to that door, quoting the founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, saying, "Prisons must be colleges for human improvement." The next day, my interrogations began again. Through several days and weeks, I got an idea of the layout of 209, of where I was. That first row on the left was all full of women prisoners in different cells, and mine was where the X is there. The second row at the time was also full of women prisoners, and the others to the right were full of men. So that morning, the woman guard brought me from my cell up, if you follow that pink arrow, up to the end of the hallway, and there I was told to put on my blindfold and to follow the shoes of an intelligence agent down the hall so I wouldn't trip wearing my blindfold. And we walked past a few doors on the left, and he took me into a room like the one up there. And this is a close-up of it here on the right. I was told to sit in a small school desk facing the wall. I still had my blindfold on, but I tipped up my head, and I saw that the wall was made something like foam. I later heard from other political prisoners that the wall is made of foam so that when the interrogators push people's heads into the wall, it doesn't do irreversible damage, but it still causes a lot of pain. The door was padded with leather, but it wasn't very soundproof, and sometimes I could hear other prisoners screaming and crying. I could hear the voices of men behind me, interrogators, calling out questions. And by listening to their voices, I thought, I counted, there must be at least four men in the room, alone with me, and no women. They told me they had been closely monitoring my emails and phone calls. I assumed that, like other journalists, foreigners, and certain others, I might have been occasionally monitored. But I knew I had nothing to hide, so I had done everything openly. My captors said they wanted to make a deal with me. They said they would free me if I confessed to using the book I was writing on Iran as a cover for espionage for the United States, and also if I agreed to spy for them. The details of this are in the book. I kept telling them, I'm innocent, please believe me, but they seemed incapable of believing me. I want to read a section of the book, if you have it, just to give you an idea of the interrogation. It's page 48. And in this section, I'm talking about a man I call Javon, which means youth in Farsi. My interrogators didn't give me their real names. They don't tell prisoners their real names because they're intelligence agents. So I gave him the name Javon in this book, because he was younger than my other interrogators. He was maybe around my age. And he dressed like the westernized youth of northern Tehran. He wore jeans and a nice leather jacket, maybe so he could fit in and spy on the youth of northern Tehran. I don't know. So here's he's questioning me. Who are Mr. B, Mrs. C, Mr. D? Javon asked, leaping to the next subject, after I wrote down what he must have considered yet another unsatisfactory answer. And what did they want from you? These were various American friends, acquaintances, or interviewees I had been in touch with in one way or another over the previous 6 years. None of them wanted anything from me, I told my interrogators. One was a journalist friend who had emailed me a few weeks earlier from America. We know he works for the Seattle Post Intelligencer, one of the agents said. That was one of the newspapers in Seattle. Yes, I said, he's a photographer there. That paper is an arm of the CIA, he continued. What do you mean? I asked. It has the word intelligence in its name. I almost scoffed in disbelief. As far as I know, the newspaper is not connected to the CIA in any way, I said. I truly do not know anyone in the CIA. What did all these people want from you? Javon asked again. Nothing. Nonsense, he barked. We know that one of these Americans wanted you to use your interviews and research for your book as a cover to gather intelligence for the U.S. government. Tell us who. How much money did you get for it? What information did you provide? I wasn't gathering intelligence for anyone, I said, raising my voice. As I told you, the book I've been writing is a personal project and not for any institution or government. And as I told you, I'm allergic to the word book, Javon retorted. But it's the truth, I insisted. You are lying. You are lying, he said, drawing out the words as if tasting them before they left his mouth. I'm not lying, I erupted. I could not sit quietly while these men insulted my integrity. Just give me a polygraph test, I pleaded as I had the day before, and you will see that I'm telling the truth. Fix your head job, another interrogator thundered at me. Do you think you're in America? Amid my outburst, my chador had slipped back on my head, exposing a few strands of hair. Sorry, I whimpered. I tugged the cloth forward and cowered in my desk. A chair scraped against the cement floor. One of the men behind me stood up and started pacing slowly back and forth. My head turned from side to side, trying to follow his movements. Back and forth. Back and forth. My captors made many threats against me and also against my family. I knew that others before me had been forced to make confessions. I had seen some on television, on Iranian state TV. Those confessions seemed obviously made under duress. Many of those people had been released shortly afterward, and some of them had recanted their confessions. I also knew that no one knew my whereabouts. I wasn't allowed to have an attorney. My captors could probably do what they wanted with me, and maybe no one would ever find out. So I thought, maybe I just have to make this false confession, so they'll release me, and I'll go somewhere safe, and then I'll recant my lies. And I gave in. I made a false confession and said, the book that I was writing about Iran was a cover for espionage for the United States. I also pretended to agree that I would spy for my captors, even though I never would have done that. I just wanted to be freed and run away. Eventually, I was taken out of solitary confinement, transferred to another cell, and over the next several days and weeks, I met other women, political prisoners, including a student activist, a humanitarian worker, and a member of a civil disobedience movement. Some of them had also been pressured to make false confessions or false statements about themselves or others they knew. But unlike me, they hadn't given in to the pressures, even though they too had been promised freedom in return. When I saw them, I saw their strength, I felt even more ashamed than I had before about this false confession that I had made. I thought, I was much weaker than I ever thought I would be under pressure. These women were quite strong. Even if I'm going to be released someday, my body will be free, but my conscience will forever remain behind bars. I wanted to recant, but I was scared to do so while I was still in custody, because still no one knew where I was. But as I got to know these women, I learned from them. I was inspired by them, and I decided I need to recant while I'm still in prison, not when I'm free. So I recanted. I later found out that I recanted my false confession just 2 days after the Iranian authorities announced publicly that they would release me within days. When I recanted, my chief interrogator, Javan, told me we knew from the very beginning that it was false. I thought, this is so strange. Why did they arrest me in the first place when they knew this, that I wasn't using my book as a cover for espionage? Why did they make me say it? They even made me say it on videotape 4 times. And how often did they knowingly falsely accuse other innocent people of crimes they'd never committed? Instead of being freed, as the authorities had announced, I was sent to trial. Except I didn't know it was a trial until about 15 minutes after it started, and the whole thing lasted about half an hour. My attorney hardly said a word, and I basically had to defend myself. I wasn't allowed to study the so-called evidence against me. I wasn't allowed to cross-examine the so-called witness, and my forced confession was used by the prosecution as evidence against me. A few days later, I was sentenced to 8 years in prison. Out of protest, I went on a hunger strike. I thought, this whole system is unjust. I'm not going to see justice. And this is my only weapon. My body is my only weapon that I have in prison that I can use to pressure the authorities to release me. I won't go into all the details now, but a few weeks later, I was taken to trial again. An appellate trial, and then I was released the next day. My parents had come to Iran by then. They had gone public with my disappearance about 1 month after I disappeared, and after that, the Iranian authorities had announced that I was in Evin prison, so then my parents came to Iran. That day I was freed, they came onto the prison grounds in a car, a friend's car, and I was allowed to get in the car and leave with them. And as we drove away, Evin prison disappeared in the background, and I cried. But I realized that my tears were not only tears of joy at my freedom, they were also tears of sorrow for the many innocent prisoners I was leaving behind. They were prisoners of conscience, many of them, whose only crime was to exercise peacefully basic human rights, such as freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. Why was I so lucky to be released while all these people had to remain behind? Was it because I had an American passport? Because I worked for some news agencies that were well known? Was it because the media may have liked the headline, "Former Miss North Dakota in an Iranian Jail"? Who were some of those people I left behind? Two of my cellmates. Do they show up here? There we go. Thank you. These are two of my cellmates. They were two of my cellmates. The woman on the left is Fariba Kamalabadi, and the woman on the right is Mahfash Sabet. They are two of the seven leaders of Iran's Baha'i community. Uh-oh, that's strange. The Baha'i community is thought to be the largest non-Muslim minority religion in Iran. When I met Fariba and Mahfash, Mahfash, the woman on the right, had been in prison already 1 year, and 6 months of that time she'd been in solitary confinement. And Fariba had been in prison for 10 months, and she'd been in solitary confinement for 4 months of that time. And these seven were facing very serious charges, including insulting religious sanctities that could lead to the death penalty. Yet they hadn't been allowed to see a lawyer even once. These seven are still in prison today. They've been there for about 2 years. Their trial is ongoing, and they also face a new charge called spreading corruption on earth. Their judge is the same judge who gave me 8 years in prison. Who else is there today? Mrs. Mofidi, she's on the left side there. She's a journalist. She worked for many reformist newspapers, and she was the head of the Association of Iranian Press Journalists. Many younger journalists looked up to her. She gave them advice about their jobs, helped them with issues like insurance, and so on. She is held today in Evan 209, where I was held. She's been there since her arrest in December. Reporters Without Borders describes her condition as critical. She has heart problems, one of her daughters said after a prison visit. She has been given very strong tranquilizers, as the interrogations are causing her a great deal of stress. Reporters Without Borders says Mrs. Mofidi is one of about 26 journalists who are in Iran's jails today, and there are also about 13 web bloggers. For a time, Iran was the largest jail for journalists in the world during this past year, and still it ranks in the top five. Many of them, and other political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, have gone through something similar to what I went through, and much, much worse. I was under a great deal of psychological and mental pressure, although I was not physically tortured. When I was released from prison, some people asked me, "Were you tortured there?" And I said, "Well, my captors didn't touch me, so I guess not." Some human rights activists told me, "Roxana, there's something called white torture, which doesn't leave a mark on your body, but it can devastate your mind and your conscience. It's a combination of intimidation, manipulation, and threats, putting you in isolation, cutting you off from the world, from a lawyer, and from your loved ones." Many prisoners in Iran today have been under white torture and black torture, which is physical torture. When I was still in prison one day, before I got my 8-year sentence, Javan, my chief interrogator, called me into an interrogation room, told me to sit down in the little desk, and said, "Raise your blindfold and look down." So I raised my blindfold, and I looked down, and I saw that there was a pile of papers on the school desk. It was printout. The top one was a printout of something from the internet. It looked like a news article. He said, "Read these." But I didn't want to read them, because I had learned by that point that if I didn't engage with my interrogators, I would aggravate them, and that was after I had recanted my false confession, and I wanted to aggravate them as much as possible. "Don't you want to read these?" he said. I said, "No, you can read them." He said, "Okay, I'll read them for you. I've highlighted the important parts for you. BBC, CNN, Associated Press, Hillary Clinton is calling for your release. Such and such a group is pushing for your release. And this group has gathered so many numbers of signatures for a petition calling for your release." I knew what he was trying to do. He wanted to say that this coverage and these calls for my release were hurting me, were detrimental to my case. He was trying to weaken me, but he was doing the exact opposite. He was strengthening me because I realized that I wasn't alone anymore, that I didn't have to face my captors alone anymore. Later, when I was on my hunger strike, my father told me in one of our meetings after he had come to Iran that other people around the world had started going on a parallel hunger strike. I was shocked. I told him, please, you have to tell them to eat. They have to eat. I sit in a cell. I'm not burning any calories, but these people have to go to work. He said, no, Roxana, they're on a hunger strike to show support for you. I went back to my cell, and at the time I was rooming with Mahfash, one of the Baha'is, and she thought this was a very beautiful thing. She wasn't jealous at all. She said, Roxana, you have an opportunity. Now there's a lot of attention on your case. When you go back to America, please tell others that our country is not only about the nuclear issue, it's also about people like us. I believe these calls for my release helped lead to my release. And the day after I was freed in May last year, I thanked journalists and non-journalists, friends and strangers, for their support when I was in prison. Pretty soon afterward, I was allowed to leave the country, and my neighbor had me kiss her Quran and pass under it 3 times for protection on my journey. We've all heard about what's been happening in the aftermath of the disputed presidential election of last year. Thousands of people were detained and dozens killed during the most significant civil unrest since the Islamic Revolution. Many people have been put on mass show trials. Some have been forced to give confessions. More than 80 people have been sentenced to up to 15 years in prison. Some have been sentenced to death. At least 2 have been executed. As limits have tightened on professional journalists, we've seen the growing impact of citizen journalists taking images and video with their phone cameras and putting them on the internet. This is an image some of you may have seen. The last moments of Neda Aga Sultan, a young woman who was shot at a protest. Also in Evin prison since last summer are the 3 American hikers. I'm sure many of you have heard of them. They haven't been able to see a lawyer once. They have called home only once. Do media attention and international attention on these human rights violations matter? I believe they do. If there weren't this kind of attention, repression could be much worse. I think international attention can help pressure authorities to release prisoners in many cases, not only just in my case, but also in the case of, for example, Mazyar Bahari, who is an Iranian-Canadian journalist. He was working for Newsweek in Iran, and he was arrested last summer. He was released after about 118 days, after many calls for his release from fellow journalists and others around the world. There are other journalists in Iran who don't have another passport and who don't work for famous news organizations. Some of them have been sentenced to many years in prison. The efforts of ordinary people are also very important. People can donate to Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the International Campaign for Human Rights on Iran, and other human rights groups. You can write letters to Iranian officials. You can also sign petitions, and if you have a piece of paper and a pen, here's one. It's called Our Society Will Be a Free Society.org. It's long. Our Society Will Be a Free Society.org. This is headed by a committee to protect journalists and others. It's a campaign to win the release of journalists imprisoned in Iran. There's another website, rsf.org, which stands for Reporters Sans Frontières in French, Reporters Without Borders. They're trying to support Iranian journalists who have had to flee their country. If those journalists had stayed, they could have been in a great deal of danger. But those journalists need to start new lives overseas, and they need help. So if you log on to rsf.org, and if you can help them, that would be great. The hikers also have a website, the hikers' families, freethehikers.org. That sign on the wall in my cell, quoting Ayatollah Khomeini, that read, "Prisons must be colleges for human improvement." In a way, it was a college for me. But the lessons I learned are probably not those lessons that my captors would have wanted me to learn. I learned, for example, not to take freedoms for granted. Not just the freedom to walk without a blindfold on, the freedom to put my head on a pillow, the freedom to call my parents and talk to them without a tall interrogator standing next to me, breathing on me, telling me what I have to say. Also, the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, the freedom of press. I also learned from what one of my cellmates told me, we can try to turn challenges into opportunities. When she told me that in Evan Prison, I thought, you must be crazy. How can you find an opportunity in this prison? What kind of opportunity can come of this challenge? But in a way, she was right. Though I wish I was never imprisoned, this challenge, my imprisonment, the biggest challenge of my life, also gave me an opportunity to see and feel injustices, not only through my own experience, but also through living with and getting to know many other political prisoners. I now feel that I have a responsibility to join others in speaking out against these kinds of injustices. We can all use the freedoms that we have to speak out for those struggling to make their own voices heard, whether they're in Iran or elsewhere in the world. Thank you for coming and giving me the opportunity to share my message with you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Parry. I'm also an Iranian-American writer, and I want to, for our radio listeners, remind you that we are speaking here at the Commonwealth Club to Roxana Sabiri, the Iranian-American journalist who was in captivity for 100 days in Evin prison in Tehran last year. And her book, her memoir, Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran is just out from HarperCollins, and I reviewed it for the San Francisco Chronicle recently, and I highly recommend it. It is a revealing portrait of the buffoonery of the Iranian Islamic Republic bureaucrats, but also a very excellent portrait of a young woman who is learning how to survive in a oppressive government situation, which is not how you grew up. You grew up in the United States.
Right.
There are some questions I have from the audience, but the first thing I want to do is ask you, as you were growing up, what did your father tell you about Iran, and what drew you to Iran? Was it that you couldn't go there, or was it?
I think as a child, I didn't have actually that much interest in my parents' backgrounds. I wanted to fit in with my friends in Fargo, North Dakota, and my friends were not Iranian Japanese Americans like me. But as I grew older, I became more interested. My father and my mother had some Iranian friends in town, and they would meet once in a while and have dinner and speak in the Farsi language and eat Iranian food. And my father also enjoyed Iranian Persian poetry quite a bit, so he would sometimes read poetry for me. But I think it was more so when I grew older that I started to realize that this is actually... I can find a wealth of new information and learn more about this other side of the world, this whole part of my identity that I never really knew. And I became much more curious about it. And especially when I wanted to become a foreign news correspondent, it seemed like it would be a very exciting place to live. And I knew that events in Iran were important not only for the region but for the entire world.
Did your father leave Iran, or did your parents leave Iran because of the revolution?
No, they left several years before the revolution. I think it was 1973.
Did they discourage you when you said you wanted to go?
At first, they were skeptical. It was a year after President Bush had called Iran a member of the Axis of Evil, along with Iraq and North Korea, and America was preparing to lead a war against Saddam Hussein in next-door Iraq. And also, my father knew I hadn't been to Iran before, and this was the Islamic Republic. But when they saw that I was determined to go, they said, be careful, but follow your heart.
This book is a memoir of your time in prison, not of your time really in Iran.
Right.
And you were there for 6 years. You learned the language, and your fiancé is Iranian, Kurdish, yeah. I understand.
Yeah, my boyfriend.
Your boyfriend. Somebody, yeah, you know. Yeah.
Actually, a lot of people get that. No, a lot of media have gotten that wrong, and then my friends have.
Right. Yeah. In her book, she says he's her boyfriend, but then I read somewhere out there on the internet that he's your fiancé.
Yeah.
So I'm very
That's
sorry.
That's okay.
A lot of
people
an oops
think
moment.
So.
Or maybe not. Who knows? And I have someone in the audience who just returned as a tourist to Iran who says that it was one of the most wonderful cultural experiences of her life, and she's curious as to how you can reconcile your experience in Evin with your life in Iran and the lifestyle that you led.
It's a very good question. I stayed in Iran for 6 years because I grew to love the country. The people were very warm to me. They didn't want me to feel alone. They knew I was away from my family, and many of them welcomed the fact that I had left America, where I'd grown up, to learn more about my father's country by going to Iran, whereas many young Iranians wanted to go the other direction. When I was released from prison, many people I would run into, like the taxi drivers or the shopkeepers or whatever, they said, "We're so sorry about what happened to you." And they were apologizing to me, and I said, "Well, it's not your fault." And my love for the Iranian people has not diminished at all because of my imprisonment. I don't think that my captors were representative of the majority of the Iranian people at all. And in fact, many Iranian people, when they see political prisoners being released, they admire them, and they treat them with a lot of respect. Even one of the, I think it was the taxi driver who told me that one of the local bazaars was selling a Roxana scarf, which I thought, what? Because I think there was a picture of me with a blue scarf in some of the media at some point. So I can't say that my love for the country has diminished at all. And in fact, I met some of the best Iranians, the best human beings that I've ever met, in my cellmates in Evin prison.
Roxana, there's so many, as an Iranian-American myself, I know that there are many misperceptions. And I'm curious, since you've written the book, and the book is about your time in Evin, I'm curious if you could give us just an idea of what it was like for you day to day. And a lot of people think oppression is oppression every moment. And although it may be in the back of your mind, knowing that you have to be public and private and you have to be careful, I know that for Iranians, life isn't necessarily on a quotidian basis that much different from life here.
Right. They find a lot of avenues for relaxation and fun. And maybe this is one of the reasons I also enjoyed Iran, is because is that work is important to a lot of people, but they also make a lot of time for play and for family. And it's important when kids grow up, they keep strong family ties with parents and grandparents. And I really liked that. So daily life in Iran, is that basically?
Well, you came and went as you pleased. Mm-hmm. You could take transportation, mass transit.
Yes.
Did you have an office that you went to?
No, I just worked out of my apartment.
You worked out of your home. And before you were arrested, you weren't afraid. on a daily basis.
No, I assumed I might be monitored from time to time, but because that's pretty natural for people like me. But I didn't think that I should change. Like, I didn't want to hide anything. I didn't have anything to hide. So I said, if they're monitoring me, at least they should know what I'm doing. And so I was very open about what I did. And I knew that others, as I said in the presentation, had been sometimes questioned for a few hours and then released. So I thought, at most, maybe this will happen to me. And I'd been there for 6 years. I thought, if they really had a problem with me before, maybe they would arrest me on the way out of the country or on the way back from the country when I was taking one of several trips to my family's. And that never happened. So it was interesting that they wanted to arrest me just 1 or 2 months before my departure. So later on, I thought about that, and I thought, yeah, if they really thought I was a spy, I don't think they would have waited to the very end of my six-year stay in Iran.
Well, don't you think it's clear that they arrested you for political reasons, not for any other reasons?
Yes, especially after my interrogator told me we knew from the very beginning that your confession was false, and later on a deputy prosecutor told me in private, more or less, that he knew I wasn't a spy. Then I realized that there must have been major political reasons behind this. Maybe my captors wanted to use my false confession to intimidate Iranians who were trying to reach out to the West and to America, because I was arrested 11 days after Barack Obama was inaugurated president, and he'd been talking a lot more about an engagement with Iran. A lot of Iranian hardliners are opposed to that because they think better relations with America could jeopardize their own positions politically and financially. I also thought maybe my captors wanted to use my arrest to intimidate other journalists or dual nationals, researchers, and so on.
When Ahmadinejad was elected in 2005, a lot of journalists, a lot of people were surprised. Mm-hmm. After the Axis of Evil speech, which you just mentioned a few minutes ago, do you think that that had anything to do with the fact that Iran became more hardline?
I think it played into the hands of hardliners who like to argue that there is an external enemy, so we have to be vigilant, and in the name of national security, they crack down on society and they try to tighten their grip on society. They say, for example, we are facing a threat, these foreigners want to overthrow our country, so we can't have critics, we have to have national unity, people supporting the regime.
I have a question from the audience here. In your book, you mention a poster of the Ayatollah Khomeini that states, "Anyone who imagines that religion is separate from politics is ignorant." Can you comment on this in relation to Iran and also in relation to other countries, including America?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this was the idea that, I guess, underlines the Islamic Republic, the foundation of Islamic Republic, that they wanted to combine politics and religion. I'm not sure if the question is that, do most Iranians agree with that, perhaps? Or
it's not my question,
yeah.
But I will try to interpret it.
Yeah.
I think the questioner is probably trying to understand whether you believe mm-hmm. in the separation mm-hmm. of church and state, and whether you think Iranians do in general. Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, it's hard to say what Iranians think because there's no public reliable poll that will tell you if they want separation of religion and state. But I think a lot of Iranians do, in talking to Iranians. And some Iranians want a whole new system other than an Islamic Republic. They want a secular system. But others say, no, we need to just have reforms within the framework of an Islamic Republic. But in the Islam should be less than the Republic, for example. Personally, I think it's difficult to have it seems contradictory, the having the religion and the democracy together in what I saw in Iran. And ideally, Iran would have a progressive democratic government that respects human rights. But that decision is up to the Iranian people themselves. And I think having a progressive democratic country, I'm not sure if it would be Islamic or non-Islamic. I think that is something that the majority of the Iranian people want.
The demonstrations, they happened, of course, after you left and after the elections, which many people say were rigged. What do you think are the chances for the hardliners to fall?
In the short run, it seems like they've really tightened their grip on power and that they're not going anywhere because they have the monopoly of economic power and security power, and they've got the judiciary, they've got the jails, they've got the siege, they've got revolutionary guards. And they were not afraid to use force and violence against peaceful demonstrators and peaceful opposition. But I think in the long run, these methods cannot succeed, because when you suppress the people who speak and write about problems and call for their basic rights, instead of addressing those problems, you breed resentment among a lot of people. When you arrest one person who has just been peacefully exercising his or her rights, you make a lot of people angry. That person's family members, that person's friends, that person's colleagues. These families get to know one another too, and they share their stories. So I think in the short run, it seems like the hardliners have tightened their grip on power, and they seem like they're going to keep their power. But I think in the long run, they cannot prevail.
This is an interesting question, which I know the answer to, but I will give it to you because it's the answer is interesting, too. How is it that in an Islamic society you were allowed to be in a room with only men, none of which were your family?
That's a very good question. Actually, what is your answer to that?
My answer to that is that Islam has nothing to do with the government in Iran. Very little.
Actually, yeah, you're right. They do things in the name of Islam, but actually their main motivation is power, to keep power. And they're willing to go to almost any lengths, even trample on the rights of innocent individuals to keep that power. And actually brought up in one of my trials to the judge when I was trying to argue that I made this false confession under pressure, I said, they were saying, you were questioned in a completely friendly atmosphere. You weren't under any pressure at all. And I said, okay, well, I was in solitary confinement. I wasn't allowed to have a lawyer. I wasn't allowed to tell my family where I was. I was interrogated by four men alone in a room. And
about sex.
About sex,
sometimes.
Too, yeah. They in the book, I talk about how they asked many questions, and they wanted me to say that I had sexual relations with a lot of people. And later on, I found out that this is one of their ordinary routine methods that they use. And the intelligence agent, the representative who was in court with me, was part of the prosecution, he stood up, he didn't stand up, but he told the judge, these are all natural things that we do in security cases. I mean, the solitary confinement and the questioning by four men and everything. So they try to justify it in the name of national security.
How does it feel? You are a journalist and you study journalism, and journalists are generally not part of their own story or of their stories. How does it feel to be an activist now, and how do you see your career as a journalist playing out, and what about the book that you were writing about mm-hmm. Iran?
Okay, I'll answer those in reverse.
Sorry, I asked too many at one time.
About the book, I hope that I don't have any immediate plans to go to write it, but I hope that I can go back to it and finish it. It has some interesting stories in it about Iranian society and people's lives. Maybe we haven't heard about those stories so much in the media. And about being a journalist and also talking about human rights, I think, well, this is something my captors did to me, actually. It's nothing that I planned, but when you are treated unjustly and you feel injustice and you get to know very well others who are being treated unjustly. It's hard to be completely objective about this. And I know I'm not the only journalist who's been in prison in Iran and come out and has turned into somebody who's advocating human rights. And if I do go back to journalism in the future, I hope that it can be linked to issues of human rights.
One last question. No, we still have a little more time.
Okay.
Well, tell me, are you in any danger now and have you received any threats? Do they try to intimidate you from afar?
I haven't received any threats since I've been released. When I was in prison, my captors told me when you're released and if you talk about our arrangements, one of them said, I will personally sign your death warrant. And my main interrogator told me, we have agents all over the world. I think you've seen how capable we are. We can find you wherever you are. If you're reporting on a trip in Afghanistan, we can kill you and make it look like you died in a car accident.
Which they've done so often.
Yeah, they have been implicated in the assassinations of dissidents overseas. And I think they do have agents in many different countries. But for one thing, I'm not sure if I'm a big priority for them right now. They have, I think, a lot of issues that they need to deal with already. And for another, I don't want to live in fear. It was fear of death and fear of man that led me to make my false confession. And it was my desire to overcome that fear that led me to recant it. Thank you.
I do have one last question which is related to that. If you read this book, you'll see on the page a political and moral or intellectual awakening, a transformation of this young woman from being afraid to basically saying, well, okay, so I die. I'm just going to have to go with the flow, and I'm going to have to stick with my story and be brave. And being an Iranian-American myself, I was raised with Iranian women and American women in my life, and I find in many ways Iranian women to be much more assertive and aggressive, even though it is an Islamic country. And I think you found that to be the case when you were in your cell with these other women. And I would like you to speak to this issue of women and their part in the quote-unquote soft revolution that, in my opinion, is taking place in Iran, just as your captors thought it was, though not because you were spying for the United States. And speak to how you think this revolution can play out as far as women are concerned and what they're doing to help it move along.
Well, about the soft revolution, the hardliners say that there is a non-violent revolution that is being masterminded by foreign powers, particularly the United States, to overthrow the regime. And it starts with the spread of ideas and exchange programs and so on, where the elites of Iran are kind of brainwashed into supporting these ideas to overthrow the regime, and they spread the ideas to the masses who then rise up against the regime or something like this. If we define soft revolution as the spread of ideas that are contrary to those that the regime wants, and I think those are like ideas about civil society and democracy, because if there is a more democratic country, that could threaten the people in power there because they don't want to share their power. If we define a soft revolution like that, but at the same time say this is not a revolution that is masterminded by America, it is being led by the Iranian people themselves,
Absolutely.
Then I agree, yeah, that there is such a thing. And women are playing a large role. They've become more and more active in Iranian society, and I interviewed many of them for the book I was writing, university students. About 65% of entrants of colleges in Iran are women. They have been more active in the workplace, and they've become active in politics, and they're women lawyers, for example. They do face many limitations still by law and also because of the patriarchal mentality that does exist among some parts of Iranian society still. But we saw in the elections last year that they were very active in the campaigning and in the demonstrations that followed. Many of them were in the forefront of the demonstrations, trying to encourage their less courageous male counterparts on. So I think that they are a powerful force for democracy in the future. They make up half the population. And as they have more and more have gone to university, become exposed to new ideas, realize universal human rights, and they want them to.
Roxana Sabeti, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. I'm sure you've all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Roxana Sabeti, author of Between Two Worlds, My Life in Captivity in Iran, Suzanne Pari, author of The Fortune Catcher, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us online and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.